All right, thank you very much for that great introduction. So, I want to ask, does anyone know what this is a picture of? We got crust, and then mantle, and then outer and inner core. Hopefully that's not new to anyone, right? Have you seen that before? Maybe high school, middle school, you know, just before you came here, you know, whatever. Okay, so I'm assuming you've seen this before, and I want to ask the question, why do we know that this is the case? How do we know that the underneath the crust, underneath our feet, that there's actually molten rock in the mantle and swirling liquid steel and then a solid inner core that's steel also? How do we know that? Or why isn't there some other equally plausible idea? I'm just going to go through a couple examples of what people in the past have thought were pretty plausible scenarios what the Earth was made of. We're going to start off with the ancient Hindus. They believed that the Earth was supported on the back of 8 elephants. The elephants were in turn supported by a turtle, and the turtle was supported by a cobra. And earthquakes happened whenever any of the animals moved. That was earthquakes. That explained it. They were good to go. Ancient Japanese, they believed that the Earth was on the back of a catfish, and that there was a demigod in charge of holding a rock over top of the catfish's head to keep him from moving, because I guess that does something. I don't know. And then every time the demigod got distracted, the catfish would wiggle a little bit and cause an earthquake. So, lots of earthquakes in India and Japan, so they got explained somehow. Fast forwarding a little bit in time, we've got Jules Verne in the 1860s. He published Journey to the Center of the Earth and gave me an awesome title. He thought that the center of the Earth was sort of cavernous and had dinosaurs and such inside. And it had a ceiling that was a glowing ball of plasma that made it look like it was just sunlight inside there. You know, convenient for storytelling purposes, because pitch black kind of gets a little bit boring. As Jules Verne, I mean, he knew it was science fiction, but not too much before him, some guy believed that the Earth was hollow. Now, of course, this sounds ridiculous to us now, but I mean, how would you convince someone that the Earth isn't hollow? You know, I mean, how would you? So he thought that there was a bunch of different layers, much like ogres and onions. And that there was a little hole at the top for sunlight to get in, so that those inner layers were also well lit, and everyone was pretty happy. No one wants to live in the dark, it's not fun. 300 BC, there and everything prior basically, everyone believed that the Earth was flat, which unfortunately has made a resurgence in the like late 1800s, early 1900s. And hence, someone drew this beautiful picture for me to copy-paste off of Google. 300 BC people weren't such great artists. But, unfortunately, it's made a comeback in the form of rapper B.O.B. Might know him from his Airplane song, among other things. Might know him from his Twitter battle with Neil deGrasse Tyson over whether or not the Earth is flat. He was convinced, and as you can see from the little text there on Twitter, once you go flat, you never go back. So yeah, seems to genuinely believe it, which is painful for everyone. And then there's my personal favorite, which is the all dirt hypothesis. I don't know how much digging you've guys done, but for me, it's always been dirt underneath of me. So why wouldn't there just be more dirt as I dug farther, right? So. Someone try and prove me wrong, right? That's sort of what I'm going to try and do here, is how can we test these hypotheses? So one of the easiest ones is to, let's go dig. That'd be great. So there's a guy named William Little in Britain. He got the nickname Mole Man because in the 1960s, he wanted to do some renovations, some home improvements, as he called them. And he wanted to dig himself a wine cellar, right? So he dug himself a wine cellar. And then he wanted a second wine cellar. And then he just kept going. And digging and digging and digging. So he dug 24 feet down, then he hit the water table and couldn't go any deeper, but continued outward underneath of his neighbor's property, underneath the street in front of him. He did this for 40 years, until finally in the 2000s, someone from the township came in and shut that down, because that's incredibly dangerous to be, you know, making a whole hollow section underneath the earth, or underneath like the street, where it's just gonna dip one of these days. So anyway, they shut that down and filled it with cement, so, mole man. So This is the deepest point that you can get to as a human on the Earth, like while still like on ground. This is the Mpeng, well, quote me on the pronunciation, gold mine in South Africa. It is 2.5 miles deep. That's like 10 Empire State Buildings stacked on top of one another. 10! It's absurdly far down. The wall temperatures down there, because you're actually getting close to the mantle, actually start heating up again. It hits 150 degrees Fahrenheit on those walls. They have to cool the walls with water and then air condition the whole thing, just so it's even a tolerable environment to work in. Crazy. Yeah, that's just the whole concept of working in a cave and having to like sweat all day rather than just being cool, you know, 50 or 60 degrees is crazy to me. But anyway, gold mine, deepest place you can stand. Now, here's another option. Instead of digging, you can go swimming. The Mariana Trench, it's in the Pacific Ocean. It's 7 miles deep. And just to give you some context what 7 miles is, that's deeper than Mount Everest is tall. Like if you took Mount Everest and just kind of turned it upside down and put it in the ocean, there would still be water above it. Not just because the sea levels rose, but because math. Also, taller than jet cruising altitude is tall. So really, really far down there. And so there's been two expeditions down there, one that by the Trieste in 1960, and one by the Deep Sea Challenger in 2012. Grand total of 3 people have ever been down to the Mariana Trench. 4 times as many people have walked on the moon. 12 people have been on the moon that far away, and yet only 3 people have been down there. So 4 times as difficult by some pretty faulty logic to get down there. Pretty crazy. But the best part about the Deep Sea Challenger one in 2012, done by James Cameron, as in Avatar movie director James Cameron. He just kind of does this on the side. This is you know, what he spends all of his money on. So one of my absolute favorite quotes from him. So there was a reporter interviewing him about you know, how the whole thing went. So here's a quote. So here I am in the most remote place on planet Earth, where I feel like the most solitary human being on the planet, completely cut off from humanity. No chance of rescue in a place that no human eyes have ever seen. And then my wife calls. Clearly they had the technology thing worked out so that she'd just call into the sub like it was no big deal. Oh yeah, and then on one of the arms of the robot they had to like, you know, manipulate things down there. They put a Rolex. And after it's still working. After 1,000 atmospheres of pressure, it's still working. So good on you, Rolex. Okay, and so now for the officially deepest thing that humans have ever accomplished, the Kola Superdeep Borehole from your friends in Soviet Russia. Started in 1970, it ultimately ended in 1993 when they hit 7.6 miles beneath the surface. Now the drill bit temperature, that's not when it's running, that's just the ambient temperature down there at 7.6 miles, 356 degrees Fahrenheit. Now imagine, you know, you got a drill bit running and it's going through solid rock. That would get significantly hotter. They figured that if they kept using it anymore, the drill bit would melt. Just crazy. And of course, you know, it wasn't just some standard tool bit, drill bit that you buy from Home Depot or something like that. This was legit drill bit technology here. Anyway, so nowadays, because they gave up on it and you know, Soviet Union collapsed and things, the spot that it used to be at, you know, I imagine it was a pretty complex facility. Now it just looks like a warehouse that got torn over and it's nothing interesting. So there's a bunch of debris around and this tiny little hole, manhole thing is all that's left. So it just so happens that's a straight shot to 8 miles beneath the surface. So yeah, that. But the problem is 8 miles is not even close. The mantle begins at 20 to 50 miles, depending on where you're measuring. So we only hit 8 on our best day, or best several decades. And we still got to get to the center of the Earth. That's 4,000 miles away. So how is it possible that we know anything about the center of the Earth? What can possibly get down there? Why do we know these things already? And the answer? Sound, yay, because I do acoustics and that's sound. So, there's really only 2 ways to get sound underground. Way number 1 is atomic bombs. Awesome at making sound underground. Problem is, there's something about geophysicists going around blowing up atomic bombs anywhere they choose just for the science. Something about it being bad for human, I don't know. But I suppose we can thank Obama for that one, so thanks. The other one, which is the main one that everyone uses, is earthquakes, which of course everyone thinks of earthquakes as these massively destructive things, which they are. This is a picture from Nepal not too long ago. Really, really unfortunate stuff. But when everyone thinks of earthquakes, they're thinking of the highly destructive parts. But there's actually two main parts to earthquakes. There's the surface waves, which are the highly destructive bits, and then there's body waves, which we'll talk about in a second. So, surface waves, neat little gifts. We've got two different kinds, Rayleigh waves and Love waves. Basically, Rayleigh waves are like ground ripples. They do this on the surface. And Love waves, they're like snakes. They do this on the surface. But both of them, super destructive. But importantly, they're both confined to the surface. So as you go deeper, they don't move as much. And so we can't use these waves to tell anything about the center of the Earth because they just don't go down there. But body waves, of which there are also two kinds. There are P waves in an awful cyan color that no one can read. And then there are S waves in an equally bad color that might be green, I don't know. But P waves, these are compressional waves that kind of, basically the displacement is in the same direction as the wave traveling. So as you can see in the little animation, it probably does it better justice than my hands. But P wave and S waves go in the opposite direction. So because this is such an important point to understand earthquakes and why we know about the center of the Earth, I want to get some volunteers. So I need five-ish people who don't mind being pushed around a little bit. Okay. One, two, three, four.
Over here.
I got five. Oh, boom, five. All right, just come on up stage. All right, so what we're gonna do is we're gonna stand in a line. And by we, I mean you guys. So stand in a line, yeah, facing out this way. Yeah, probably don't want your beer for that. I don't know. Put it off the side. You're gonna need your hands a little bit. Okay, all right. So here's what we're gonna do. These guys are gonna be atoms. Oh, I didn't think about this. This is gonna block the whole screen. That's fine, we don't need it. Okay, so you guys are gonna be atoms, and first you're gonna have you be solids. So what I want you to do is I want you to do this with your hands. All right, but now I want you to interlock them with the person next to you. Yeah, perfect, perfect. Okay, so you guys are atoms in a solid, and we can tell you're solid because you have such strong bonds between the person next to you, hence the elbows. So what we're gonna do is I'm gonna push the first person here, and we're gonna watch a P wave. So I'm gonna push this way, and we're gonna watch the wave travel that way. So it's P wave who's going the same direction. I'm gonna push him, and we're gonna see it travel down the end of the way. So probably won't work great for these guys, but you guys in the good seats will have a great view of it. All right, P waves in solids. I'm gonna do that again. All right, it was a little bit weak, but we'll work with it. All right, that's P waves. So conclusion there being that solids go well, P waves go very well through solids, except this solid. Okay, so now we're gonna do shear waves, S waves. So now how these work is that the motion is in a different direction than the wave propagating. And so what we're gonna do is I'm gonna grab the first person here, go like that, cool. Yep. In a second. Yeah. Okay, so whatever. You guys prepared? You ready? All right. Much better solid, much better. Okay, so everyone saw how that worked? Solids, S waves, those work. So now liquids. So now you guys don't have as strong of bonds with each other anymore, so put your arms sort of like that, but make your shoulders touch with the person next to you. Yeah, perfect. Okay, all right, so same deal, P waves. I'm gonna push them, let's see what happens. Nice, much better liquid, you guys. Okay, all right, so now shear waves, S waves, we're gonna do the same trick. I didn't see a wave. I don't know about you guys. All right, so conclusion, solids, they get P and S waves. Liquids, only P waves, no S waves. That's important. All right, let's thank our volunteers. They did awesome. Thank you so much, guys. So, to catch us up here, there you have it. So, what can we do with this information? So now, I'm gonna make a little simulation here. We've got two different cross sections of the Earth, right? This is basically take the whole Earth, right, and just kind of cut it in half. And this is my all dirt hypothesis. So what you're seeing right here is just all dirt, and then the little color or the little lines around here is just for markers so we can see, you know, what kind of angles and stuff we got to play with. So we've got P waves and S waves on the left, nothing playing yet. But in a second, I'm gonna hit play, and we're gonna watch an earthquake occur right at the, let's say, North Pole right here. And we're going to watch how those P and S waves spread as they go through the Earth. And so, you ready? Ha-ha, worked. So, what we're seeing here is the P wave wavefront going from the top all the way down to the bottom, and S waves are a little bit slower, but same effect. So, moral of the story here is that if the Earth was entirely all dirt, then whenever there was an earthquake, we would expect to measure P waves and S waves on both sides, on all points on the Earth, right? That makes enough sense. I should tell you the time scale here, and it seems like a couple seconds, but it's actually like about half an hour for waves to get from top to bottom, roughly, in the real Earth. Anyway, all dirt hypothesis says that. We can tack on some gravity, which basically says that near the center of the Earth, it's a lot tighter, and therefore, like the speed of sound is a little bit faster, so it does this sort of nice, like, arc-y thing. But the end result's still the same, that we'd be able to record P and S waves on the surface if the Earth was entirely made out of dirt. So let's see what we actually measure. So we go out with our seismometers and put them all over the Earth and see what happens. So let's suppose there was an earthquake right at the point where I have a little star there. So people put the seismometers there, and they measured P waves through most of the Earth, but there's a small stripe near the bottom where they don't get it. So they get this like big cap and this tiny little cap at the bottom, but there's a stripe called the P wave shadow zone, very cleverly named. That is not predicted from the all-dirt hypothesis, so some weird's going on. And then S waves are only found just in the top, you know, half-ish, a little bit more than half. So neither one of those fit with S wave shadow zone. Neither one of those fit with an all-dirt Earth. So what's going on here? Why do we get this stripe? Why is this so weird? So thankfully, some smart guys have come before us, and this smart guy happens to be named Bino Gutenberg, a German physicist. And he, back in the like early 1900s, he looked at this data and was like, I know it's down there. It's a liquid core. He's done this kind of stuff before, he knows. So what we found, by we I mean people who came long before me, is that when they had very, very careful seismometer measurements, they found that there was something wonky going on down here in the P wave shadow zone. They measured some P waves that didn't belong there, couldn't be explained for any other reason, but they were super weak. But it took a lot of very careful seismic measurements to determine the fact they weren't just accidents or, you know, weird little blips in the data. They belonged there. So the question is, what's going on there? Those don't belong. So it took yet another super smart person named Inge Lehmann. Probably butchered that as well. No, I didn't. Well, I think someone said, no, I didn't, so go me. First woman seismologist, so that's pretty cool. She saw this data and thought, you know what might be down there? A solid inner core, which she predicted in 1936, but the technology wasn't around to confirm that until 1970, which is pretty awesome. And just to give you some sort of impression of just how weak and how difficult it is to come up with the conclusion that she did so early, someone who knows better than I do has this to say. The inner core was discovered through exacting scrutiny of seismic records by a master of a black art for which no amount of computerization is likely to be a complete substitute. It's impressive. I mean, granted, they're talking about computers from the 1970s or so, so it's, you know, our computers are probably better. Maybe they could do it now. I'm not going to brag, but maybe. But she did it, like, way before that was possible, so props to her. In February 2015, so, like, only a year and some change ago, they found the aptly named inner core. This is the inner core turns out to also have a core. And basically it's two different crystals aligned in different directions such that the speed of sound is slightly different depending on which way you're traveling, whether or not you're going up and down or left and right. And basically of the half hour earthquake time from point A to point B, this accounts for a 4-second discrepancy in whether or not it's going north, south, or east, west. 4 seconds on just half an hour. And think about how careful these measurements are going to be. Like, if you have a truck going by, you know, it's ruined. You have the surface waves from the earthquake going by, you're never going to see these waves. Super duper precise measurements in order to come to this conclusion, and confidently enough to get published in Nature or Science or something. So, impressive. Anyway, inner core. So, here's the question. Who cares, right? I mean, it's cool, right? It makes for a fun nerd night talk, maybe. But who really cares? How am I going to turn this into dollars, right? So probably the best one, the best use of this stuff, is to predict and understand earthquakes. 80% of the world's earthquakes occur in the Ring of Fire, outlined in red here, which we know is the Ring of Fire because of plate tectonics, which weren't discovered until after we'd understood that the Earth has a mantle that it rests on top of, and that there were a crust with a bunch of plates, you know, going underneath or, you know, creating Earth. So because of, you know, seismology measurements, we're able to conclude this stuff about earthquakes and also know where to put our seismometers so that we can get better estimates on this kind of stuff. This was one of my favorites, radioactive waste disposal. So what we got here is just a random Google image of something glowing, but the main point is that if you had, let's say, some depleted uranium that you wanted to get rid of and you didn't want to go stick it in a mountain because people would get upset about that, what you could do is put it into a giant tungsten ball, right? And now this stuff's highly radioactive, so it's shooting off neutrons and basically getting very warm, like several thousand Celsius warm. Something that hot, encased in tungsten, which is one of the highest boiling or melting point temp, or whatever. It's strong. It would go through the Earth, like it would tunnel because it's so hot, it would just melt the dirt underneath of it and keep on melting and melting and melting, and the dirt above us, you know, would re-solidify or whatever. But it would actually tunnel straight through, and it wouldn't get to the center of the Earth, but it would get through most of the mantle, which is pretty cool. So it's a possible way for us to get rid of nuclear waste, but it's one of the classic issues of we don't really fully understand what's going on down there, so let's just dump our trash and hope it doesn't happen like CO2 did to our atmosphere. So I don't know if it's the way forward, but it's a way. So next one, nuclear test ban treaty. So this was mostly because of the Cold War so many seismometers were put all around the Earth. But usually people aren't really testing nuclear bombs anymore, except for, you know, North Korea. And we know about those North Korean bombs because of seismometer measurements that allow us to see, like, kind of like pinpoint where some sort of unexplained, seemed like an earthquake, but not really, happened. So thank you, North Korea, for giving us some data. Oil exploration. Most of the oil that is found in the world that wasn't just gushing out of plains in Texas was found by something like this. They have what they call a thumper truck, and they just bang on the ground, and then some other, basically microphones, listen to what happens with time and distance, and they find they can figure out speed of sounds, and that gets us to densities and therefore to oil. So a lot of oil is found this way. Also applies to in the ocean. But yeah, oil exploration. Diamonds, every geophysicist's best friend. These really awesomely are formed in the mantle. There's not many things that we can ever contact in the mantle, but diamonds are one of them. They're created in the mantle because that's the only place you can get such high temperatures and pressures. And then the only ones that ever come back to the surface either come up very, very slowly over, you know, millions or billions of years from continental drift, or they come up from a volcanic eruption that brings them up. And that's how most of the diamonds that we have are today. There's also some extra bonuses of asteroids or meteorites falling, but aliens. And then the last one is an important one. The Earth's magnetic field would be nothing without the liquid inner core. Now, the magnetic field, you know, who cares? It just helped us with compass or whatever. But actually, if we didn't have a magnetic field, then the sun's rays, or the radioactive, or let's say radioactive parts of the sun, would hit the atmosphere, right? And that would slowly get stripped away. We would lose our atmosphere if it was not for the magnetic fields. So thank you, solid or liquid metal in the Earth spinning. We needed that. All right, so in summary, we have that earthquakes are used by geophysicists to ultimately figure out what the center of the Earth is like, which guys the crust, mantle, inner and outer core, as well as the inner core. And you can monetize that in a couple of different ways. So here's my references to prove that I didn't steal all those pictures. And thank you very much. I'll take any questions.